This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
I'm Stephen Metcalf, and this is the Slate Culture Gabfest. Orson Welles in a snuggy edition. It's Wednesday, November 7th, 2018. On today's show, Orson Welles spent years, years and years trying to finance and shoot and finish a movie called The Other Side of the Wind. Netflix has made a documentary about it and finished the film, and probably we watched both. And then Robin with a Y, the Swedish dance pop authoress, has a new record. We discuss with Slate's music critic Carl Wilson. And finally, a director makes a hit movie after which he gets a blank check. It's a familiar pattern in Hollywood history, and there's a podcast about it. And I will just segue right into introducing our fill-in for Julia this week. David Sims is the co-host of Blank Check, and he's the film critic for The Atlantic. Hey, David, welcome to our show.
Hi, thank you for having me, guys.
Yeah, thanks a lot for coming in. And of course, Dana Stevens is film critic of Slate.com. Hey, Dana.
Greetings, Stephen. I'm filling Julia's robot role.
Weird fun fact about today's show is we're angsty about an ambiguity and undetermined outcome that are that is now determined for our listeners. So we're going to be angsty and they hopefully won't be.
About Election Day, you mean?
Right.
Yeah, it's dramatic irony. They all know something that we don't know as they listen.
It's like, exactly. It's like the episode of Mad Men. Okay. There is no quick way to do justice to either Orson Welles, the giant of American cinema, nor his last great passion project, until recently incomplete, The Other Side of the Wind. But imagine Welles nearing the end of his life and career, a gigantic figure in both senses. He's both an American Shakespeare containing the cosmos in his own sensibility in a way, and part Falstaff, a just gigantic, comical, self-loving, larger-than-life figure of pure charisma. And he wants to make a movie to end all movies, a send-up of new Hollywood and European art cinema. It's a movie within a movie. It's a mockumentary. It stars John Huston, his one arguably, he thought, certainly one peer in Hollywood, and Peter Bogdanovich, at the time, his maybe one plausible heir, and on and on and on. If I start, I won't be able to stop. I think what we need to do is listen to a clip, and then we will discuss not only The Other Side of the Wind, but the documentary Netflix has made about it called They'll Love Me When I'm Dead. Clip away.
Well, here it is, the Gospel according to Jake. God the Father is an old Jew invented by a lot of other old Jews in a hopeless attempt to put down the Jewish mother.
Jewish mother?
That's what he says the whole new scene's about, you know, everything. Even his movie.
What's that about the movie? You mean the one
we don't talk about the movie. Try the Baron here. Under torture, he might squeal a little. He writes scripts.
So Mr. Hannaford likes to say.
Please, don't pretend to be stupid. Now, you're supposed to be the brainy one in this club or this, I don't know, this clan, whatever it is you
call
it.
It's a highly informal organization, lady.
The tape that we were hearing, the subject is God. Is he a member?
She. We're all ruled by the wind, aren't we, lady? So if the Lord is a lady and God's will is her will, then we can all relax and stop expecting the universe to be logical.
You heard the man, lady. We're right back where we started. Back to Mama.
Now that's...
Oh, man. Okay, Dana, I'm going to start with you. This movie is an insane potpourri. I mean, the one thing I might lead you with a little bit here is listeners, people who haven't seen it yet, they may be better off starting with the documentary. Am I right? Am I wrong?
I don't know. I was torn about this. I actually was tweeting back and forth with some other critics who were watching it, of course, on opening night, you know, when they dropped it on Netflix last Friday. And some people were saying documentary first because you can put it in context. Ultimately, I started the documentary and then realized I don't want to know this much. And after about 10 minutes, I reverted back and saw the movie. What did you do first, David?
I did this. I was also weighing which way to go. And I started the movie sort of paused at being like, wait, what is going on? But then resolutely I powered through, watched the documentary, and then went back to, I did movie. I watched the movie again after the doc.
I see, a sandwich.
Just with a little more, you know, having now marinated on what made it happen or things like that.
Yeah.
But
I don't have a strong recommendation either way. Yeah,
yeah,
because you're going to go in at any rate knowing that it's a crazy mishmash that, I mean, this is what I'm going to start off my commentary on, that is not really an Orson Welles movie in some way. I mean, I feel like the documentary, which we can get to later, does not grapple nearly enough with the fact that there were 100 hours of footage that had only been put together in a very rough way by Welles, and that some people who are somewhat vaguely defined in the Morgan Neville documentary had to impose their own vision on what this 100 hours was going to be. How would it be turned into a 2-hour narrative? And I feel like this is being unproblematically presented by Netflix. I mean, you know, you can see the advertising potential in that, but they're presenting it as the lost Orson Welles movie, when in fact, I have no doubt that Orson Welles would have despised that documentary.
Well, for one, it's very Wellesy with all the quick cuts and the sort of montage-y, like it's trying to sort of
we can get
pay
to,
homage.
Yeah, we can get
right.
to it later, but I mean, I feel like he would have despised that documentary because of the knowledge that it kind of posits about him, right? Because it tries to frame him in a way that I think he would have hated to be framed. I think Bogdanovich in an interview in the documentary even says something like that. That he was always trying to escape, you know, being summarized or personified. But I also wonder, would Orson Welles have hated this cut of his movie and the fact that it was brought out at this time? I'm just not quite clear on the fact, and I don't think the coverage has made it extremely clear why this is happening now, when the footage has existed since whatever, since Orson Welles died in 1985,
right?
And who is the driving force behind putting it together? I know that there's a contemporary editor, Bob Murawski, who went in and he's credited as the editor along with Welles. But I still feel like there has to be an authorial voice that's choosing each of these cuts and the length of each of these cuts.
And who is it? Yeah.
Yeah.
But David, this raises an interesting question, which is the thesis, if I get it right, of the documentary, such as it is, by the end of it, is that maybe Welles wanted the movie to be so open form that it was unfinished, and even goes on to suggest that people kind of talking about the movie is the movie. I mean, there's this sort of grand deconstructive gesture, sort of by Welles himself in archival footage, saying that this thing was truest to itself, incomplete. And then they give you the complete film side by side with it. I mean, it's kind of an odd way of going about it.
And it does seem, I know that Welles was out of money a lot of the time, and that he wasn't just facing off against himself as he was working on this movie for 10 years and never completing it. But there is something about that. He was always rolling the ball up the hill, but the hill, there was no summit at the top. Like, maybe that was part of this project to him, was that it was something he could always sort of return to and tinker and mess around with. And
that's certainly part of the content of this project.
Right.
I mean, we get into this, as Morgan Neville, the director of the documentary, put it, it's a Matryoshka doll of movies, right? I mean, it's a movie by a filmmaker that was never finished, about a filmmaker who makes a movie that was never finished. So we should probably talk about what happens in the actual movie called The Other Side of the Wind, which is, in fact, two movies called The Other Side of the Wind, because it contains a film within a film by the same title.
Right.
All right, that was confusing enough. David, can you clarify some?
I guess so. I mean, it's the film Orson Welles' The Other Side of the Wind is about an aging filmmaker played by John Huston.
Was he Jack?
No, it's played by John Huston. who
it's gonna take me a second to stop off. That was very funny.
Who has made this sort of Antonioni-esque, Euro sort of schlocky art film with a lot of nudity and sort of long, silent walking around and takes and things that is sort of baffling to his old Hollywood pals. He's mixing with the new Hollywood pals, and there's a big party that
for his 70th birthday.
Right. That is his last day on Earth, we know. We're told, you know, as the movie begins, in voiceover by Peter Bogdanovich, who also mentions cell phones, and Peter Bogdanovich is playing this director's sort of young protege, as Bogdanovich was Welles's protege.
If I can just jump in and say, there's a thing that Welles himself didn't ask for, right?
There's this
moment talking about computers and cell phones. It's the modern day Peter Bogdanovich, who's in his 70s, doing a voiceover. I'm not saying that it's a bad way to start the movie, but it was not a choice that Welles made. So
no, Welles wasn't thinking too hard about cell phones or Netflix in 1970, whenever he was making these movies. And so it's a sort of the last day in this grand old director's life, as he's trying to work on this movie. I'm trying to summarize the plot, and I'm failing
miserably.
Well,
let me jump in and at least summarize the feeling, and maybe you guys can jump in and contribute to this too. So what it feels like when you're watching The Other Side of the Wind, and we'll leave aside for the moment the question of authenticity and whether this is what Wells intended, but the experience is this very layered and kind of jumbled experience that is extremely... This sounds like a negative word, but I don't necessarily mean it that way. It's inconsistent in tone. It's constantly varying and heterogeneous in tone, right? So there's bits that are shot in 16 millimeter, in 8 millimeter, in black and white. And then the film within a film, almost to a frame, is this perfectly composed, beautifully lit, 35 millimeter, as you say, almost a parody of an Antonioni-style European art film. Right. And part of that, those differences in look and feel have to do with budgetary constraints and the fact it was being made at wildly different times, as the documentary covers. It was made over the course of 6 years. Right. And people were dropping out of the project and storming off the set. And he had to recast that Bogdanovich role.
Bogdanovich role was going to be Rich Little.
Was going to be Rich Little, the impressionist, right, who is now just in one little scene as a party guest. And so all of that jumbling happens on the screen before you. But I have to say it is pretty effectively woven into some kind of story with the conceit that these different looking bits of film footage all come from the paparazzi that are constantly surrounding him and the students that are asking him pretentious questions, as you heard in that clip, and that all of these people are recording this famous director, Jack Hannaford, is that his name?
Jack Hannaford. Wait, is it Jack? Because I don't want to get... I
know everybody's
It's Jake Hannaford. Jake Hannaford. See? Jack to his friends.
Steve, how did you feel about that that jumbling? I mean, you could experience that as something really challenging and kind of pleasurable, but it's a little bit alienating.
Right. Well, in the documentary, he says that he had been... I mean, he doesn't use the word painterly, but that he composed his frame with the utmost care in his previous films. And he wanted this one to be a kind of porous and open frame. And that fits in with the feel and the theme of the movie. And in that sense, I mean, it's just it's a historical document more than it is in any sense, a cogent work of art. Its lack of cogency was what it was about in some ways. But I made a list as I went along of like any one of these would be a huge alarm bell in any movie, and they're all true of this one. There's no script. It contains a film within a film. Wells himself says it's a movie about death. When asked what The Other Side of the Wind might mean, he said life. You never want to answer a question with either life or death as the answer. It starred his own best friend as his alter ego. It sends up not only Hollywood movies, but European movies. We talked about that. It stars your mistress. That's a big... I mean, even Citizen Kane tells you that's a bad sign.
Yeah, we have not even mentioned true. Oya. So Oya Kodar, who was Wells' partner at the end
Long-time
of his life.
Long-time companion, I think, right? Like for many years.
Yeah. And she's also the credited co-writer as this. She never speaks a word. She appears only as the star of the film within a film and sort of sometimes on the periphery of the party scene.
Yeah, she is in the
party exactly. Co-author of an unscripted film. Features cameos by other film directors. The cinematographer is the cinematographer who worked with Ed Wood. The budget is supplied by the Shah of Iran. So when you add all that up, I came out of this, you know, we've talked on this show about sort of creative diptychs, like you're sort of a Tolstoy person or a Dostoevsky person, a Lenin or a McCartney person, Updike or Roth, whatever. I came up with another diptych, which is Wells or Billy Wilder. I walked away team Billy Wilder. I mean, I don't mean to be, I think it's an incredible experience to watch it and to watch the documentary, even though the documentary is preposterously, overly, self-consciously done. I mean, I learned a lot about Wells, and Wells is a totally captivating figure, but he was breathing in the oxygen only of his own mythology by the time he made this movie, and that, at the end, to me, was just totally oppressive.
There is something oppressive about this movie, no question. I mean, and it is, in a way, about a moment when cinema was, I mean, you know more about this than me, Steve, about New Hollywood, and a moment when cinema was, as Wells had known it and had come from, was kind of moribund. And the movie really plays that out with these two casts, essentially. There's the cast of old Hollywood kind of dinosaurs, you know, who hang around and question what this arty movie is about and are often filmed in black and white so that it looks like an old Orson Welles movie. And in that group, you have Edmund O'Brien, Mercedes McCambridge, George Jessel, an old vaudeville star. Like, there's people from literally the first quarter of the 20th century stars mixed in with all these people like Bogdanovich, Dennis Hopper, who are some of the new cinema people. Claude Chabrol is a character.
Henry Jacklum, right?
Right.
Yeah.
dragon.
And so it's like the acolytes on one side, you know, are oppressive in one way, right, that we hear in that scene, that they're all kind of pretentiously hovering over the text, trying to bring out the Freudian meanings. And there's all kinds of really, really bad kind of psychoanalytic phallic imagery and stuff. That's just
and
so
there's
dated
also
now.
Swipes, yeah, swipes at Pauline Kael, who had published
more
a
than
giant
swipes.
Essay.
Yeah, there's a, well, there's a character who's a proxy for Pauline Kael, played by Susan Strasberg, daughter of Lee Strasberg.
More than swipes is inspired by the Kael essay on Citizen Kane, where she all but accuses him of plagiarizing the movie from Mankiewicz.
Right. So he's got this proxy for Pauline Kael, who's just a sort of an awful character. Although in our modern age, she comes off better than a lot of the men in the story.
She does, and also given what a low bar there is for representation of film critics in films, she at
That's
least
true.
You know, she's
That's
sort of
true.
Poised and intelligent, you know, compared to insert I don't know the critic in Birdman, or I'm trying to think of like nasty
yeah, no,
critics
that's a
in
good
movies,
one.
Right?
Yeah, species of subhuman, basically.
But still, she does get clocked in the face at one point, which feels a little too pointed.
Yeah, that's pretty harsh.
David, I want to hear. Are you at all tempted to make a defense of this movie as a movie, or more as a curiosity?
I mean, that's a good question. To me, it did feel a little tough to evaluate as like one of 2018's films, like. I suppose, you know, this is in theaters this year. Shouldn't I be viewing this and thinking, like, is this going to make my my top 10 this year? And that just sort of feels ludicrous, because it does feel not like a museum piece exactly, but like this this fascinating, like, it's like only one part of a project that you have to consider from a few angles. And the documentary is another part, but there's a sort of a third part that I wanted to know more about, like,
which the documentary should have covered. I mean, if I can get to the documentary
really
for a second, it's
right.
directed by Morgan Neville, who's
right.
great. He made this year's runaway success, the Mr. Rogers doc.
Right.
He made an Oscar-winning documentary, 20 Feet from Stardom, mm-hmm. that I think we've talked about on this show.
He made The Best of Enemies, I remember, I think.
Yeah, I mean, he's like the top of the profession, and I see why Netflix called him in to do this. But his documentary has a major, major lacuna, which is that it doesn't talk about exactly the thing I mentioned earlier, like what happened to the footage in between the death of Orson Welles and his main collaborator on this project, and now, and you know, who sat down with this footage and decided to do what they did with it. That missing from the documentary, to me, makes it a deeply flawed documentary. It also has this framing device with Alan Cumming being reflected in different computer screens.
That, right.
that really actually reminds me of that joke Jon Stewart used to do, where the camera angle would change and he would turn around really artificially to address like the second camera. It feels that fake. Anyway, I strongly disliked this documentary, although you do learn something about what happened between 1970 and 1976 in the making of the movie.
Sure.
You learn
right.
a lot. You don't learn, yeah. Jack, anything about what happened after that, which
right.
is what you
right.
really need to know to evaluate the document before you.
Right.
Yeah, and also you learn, I'd love to hear both of you speak to this, but you also learn that the extent to which Welles not only didn't get a blank check, he got fucked repeatedly by Hollywood because they saw him as an ambitious maverick, you know, kind of high on his own supply and a waste of money. And so he was just constantly begging for, and it was this incredible discrepancy between the kind of po-faced reverence they showed him at like AFI banquets for having made, obviously, Citizen Kane, Lady from Shanghai, and Touch of Evil, on and on and on, but mostly Citizen Kane, and a complete reluctance to show him any money at all.
Yeah, I mean, one thing, the documentary was a fun watch as a sort of Welles homage, and the first chunk of it, which is more focused on what you're talking about, his constant struggles to get projects made the way he wanted them to get made, is sort of like a decent potted history of like Orson Welles' Hollywood career and European career. And the documentary does make that point that this movie feels reactive to, you know, the European movies that are coming across the shore in the 60s, where Welles is sort of regarding them with like, wait, they're getting to do this now, and I never got to do
yeah.
this? Like, what the heck's going on?
The same thing with the sexual frankness of this
right,
movie,
right?
Which Welles yeah. could never have done, but this movie is dirty as hell. Like, it's got some scenes that are hard R's, put it
oh,
that
sure.
way.
Sure, and it...
The
and
scene the, in the car, oh my God.
And exactly, and this, so it... I appreciated like The Other Side of the Wind as, again, this sort of like this interesting artifact of Welles sort of maybe finally busting out of the constraints that had been imposed on him for almost his entire career, and almost acting out. Like, there's something babyish about it, which I enjoyed. Like, I like the childishness of him being like, I get to play in this sandbox now. As you said, Dana, like, there's I want to know how this footage was assembled. I want to know about, like, Frank Marshall, who I think was someone who pioneered or who spearheaded getting it onto Netflix. Like, I want to know how they confronted all of this footage and got it to the finish line.
Yeah, without that, I feel like, Steve, in answer to your question, is it an artifact or a movie? It's kind of more of an artifact. I mean, right. If you are a cinephile, it's an incredibly fascinating artifact, and I'm glad it's out there. But the way that it's being presented by the documentary and just by the kind of unquestioned crediting of the people behind it makes it a little bit suspect to me as an Orson Welles movie. Mm-hmm. Okay. But can I also just push back on your Welles versus Wilder diptych? I just think
that's completely artificial.
I mean, it's sort of like saying I like the pilot who wasn't shot down or something. I mean, Billy Wilder was a success. He worked within the system, right? Uh-huh. He sort of knew how to budget his resources
envelope a little bit or do something like go ahead.
His career obviously is not this grand shipwreck. So I'm not saying that you can't love Billy Wilder's films more. You absolutely can. You can dismiss Orson Welles out of hand if you want. But I just don't think that that's a fair parallel to draw.
Of course, it's totally unfair and it's facile to the nth degree. That's the point of it. But the only idea that I would defend is that it's a fun construct for trying to understand what kind of person you are. I don't know, whatever, fuck it. I can't defend it. But what we've talked about this. This is our passion project. It's become about life and death itself in a way. But anyway, it's The Other Side of the Wind is the name of the Welles film that's been sort of completed. And They'll Love Me When I'm Dead is the documentary.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Okay, before we go any further, Dana, I'm sure that you've got some business. What do you have?
Really, just to tell you about our Slate Plus segment today, which is going to be based on David Sims' podcast, Blank Check, which is all about directors who get blank checks, a director who makes a big, successful Hollywood movie and then gets to make a passion project, which is sometimes weird, disappointing, and unexpected swerve in his career or her career. So we're going to spin out from that idea in our Slate Plus segment and just talk about which directors we would like to see get a second chance, living or dead. It's just going to be one of those fun, shoot the breeze Slate Pluses. I'm excited for it. Slate Plus, if you don't know about it, is Slate's membership program, and it's a way to support the magazine. For $35 for your first year, you can help cover the cost of producing the Culture Gab Fest and all of your other favorite Slate podcasts. And in return, you get extended ad-free versions of this show and other great Slate shows and many other benefits. So if you want to support the Culture Gab Fest, you can go to slate.com/culture plus and join Slate Plus today. Okay, on with the show, Steve.
Robin with a Y has come out with her first record in 8 years, and this absolutely lit up my Twitter for reasons that I didn't understand. So we're exploring further. I craved another immersion in the salty springs of that unique Robin feeling, wrote Carl Wilson in his summary of the album, his review of the album on Slate. Chilly at the surface, but warming underneath, music about taking such full possession of your own sadness that it transports you to unsuspected joys. Carl, welcome to the show.
Hi.
I want you to know that actually does describe to a T my experience of listening to Robin with a Y. Let's start with the word crave. So there was this hiatus. She's come back with a new album, and you craved more material from her. For those listeners of our listeners who, like me, really don't have much of a deep background in Robin with a Y's music, what were you craving? What were you missing? Why is this a big deal? She's back.
Well, Robin's last album, Body Talk, which came out as a series of EPs and then was gathered together as an album in 2010, was full of really indelible dance songs that were also songs of heartbreak, that all of them were kind of created an addictive effect, and they've come back and circled around in the culture over the time since then. Songs like Dancing on My Own, particularly, which has surfaced as on a lot of TV soundtracks. There's a memorable scene from an early season of Girls where Hannah breaks out into a frenzied dance to Dancing on My Own in her bedroom, that really sort of conveyed that Robin feeling, this sort of sense of desperation, but at the same time being swept up by the beat. And because that music has been circulating and become kind of staple in the past 7-8 years, that sense that there would be more, and at the time she was very prolific, was unanswered in the past 8 years, because Robin went through a series of personal difficulties. She lost Christian Falk, who was a producer who'd worked with her from early on when she was a teen pop star. And she also went through relationship problems with a boyfriend who she's since reunited with, but was broken up with for a few years. And so she retreated basically to go into psychoanalysis for a period of time, and put out a few bits of collaborative music with dance producers on several EPs in 2014 to 2017. So when hints started to emerge in the past year that a new album was coming, the anticipation has been building. And it was finally answered this week with this new album, Honey, which has a different feeling, a feeling that reflects those years of introspection and sort of self-care over this period of time. And it's a less insistent, less driving album, and one that's more deep and rich in texture, but still has many of the same qualities. That combination of pleasure and pain is, if anything, just heightened on the new record.
Mm-hmm. Well, why don't we, before we go any further, why don't we listen to some, like, a really distinctive track from old Robin? Why don't you pick one for us?
Yeah, well, why don't we go back to, there was a sort of important break that happened between her first attempt being marketed by major labels, and then at one point she broke off on her own and decided that this was a sort of dissatisfying way to pursue her career, and put out this album just called Robin in 2005. The music took a couple of years to reach us in North America, but the song Be Mine is probably the most iconic of that period. So you can hear in that song the sort of Swedish Ice Queen tone of her voice in a way, but that combined with that kind of real willingness to go all the way emotionally. And that's the kind of paradox that I think has always been magical about her.
Carl, since we went back in time and listened to that old track, I have a question about production. And I don't even know how to frame this question because I'm bad at even the terms of music production. But what has changed between then and now that her new album sounds so much, I don't know how to describe this, I don't mean it in a bad way, but less clean than that? It's got like a lot more layers of sound and more electronic sound. And has she changed producers? Does she produce her own songs? How does that work?
She's producing herself more than she ever has before on this album. And part of what she's been doing during the interim has been training herself more in production. But she tends to work with a small handful of Swedish producers, and dance producers. And yeah, there is a slightly different configuration of people here than there was at that point. But I think it's also a very deliberate thing. And talking about layering is right. At that point, when at the time of songs like Be Mine, you could really hear there was the synthesizer, there was her voice, there was the beats. And then they'll, on Be Mine, there's a string component. And those parts are all sort of cleanly delineated, and they're all falling in a very sort of four on the floor way. Whereas on this album, the beats are, yes, more layered, and there's different sort of counterpoint happening in the music in a different style than did in her early work.
Can you think of a sample we could listen to from the new album that shows that?
I think probably the title track, Honey, is the most easily recognizable of that. No!
I love Robin. I was in college in England when her self-titled album that B minus from came out. And I remember that being a staple for me that year. I guess she hit in Britain first before cresting in America. But I've always loved how bittersweet she is and how melancholy her songs are. And so I was kind of stunned that she somehow like has plumbed new depths of melancholy with this album. Like I've always loved how propulsive her songs are, even when they're about the inevitability of sadness or, you know, how any relationship might be doomed to die or things like that. And I turned this album on and I will admit, like, initially I was sort of like, where are the bangers, you know, to use the nomenclature.
Yeah, I mean, I think we kind of just heard it. I feel like the only real banger. One that hops out as a banger is this Honey, the title track, which is a beautiful song. I mean, incredible.
It is. I do like that. It's been growing on me very nicely. I've been enjoying putting it on as I'm. It's a good headphone album. Very good sort of like soundscapey walking around in the rain.
Making
album.
Your lonely soundtrack for your life.
Yes.
Yeah.
But it definitely was more of a grower than her past few records were for me.
Yeah, I think that's the thing that's really distinct about this album. And some fans did react with disappointment initially. And I found it a little difficult to get into at first, seeking that immediate adrenaline rush hit from Robin's style. But really, as I listened to it, I found that more and more there was this other kind of deeper rhythm that I can only describe as a kind of body rocking rhythm. And it really does kind of have that connotation with self-soothing that the story behind the album suggests, that perhaps this music was made as a sort of self-healing exercise. And as I listened to it, I could really get deeper and deeper into that sort of push and pull that she does here, rather than that sort of driving forward, accelerating feeling, that sort of transporting feeling. This is really an album about centering yourself back in yourself. And it still has a lot of playfulness and humor along the way, which she always does. But it really, yeah, it's a more of a deep sitting in yourself album. And, you know, it's an album, you know, Body Talk, those songs were made when she was in her mid to late 20s. And this is an album by a 39-year-old woman who's been working on it for several years. And it really does feel like a more mature revision of what Robin can do.
Yeah, Carl, I didn't know until you mentioned it that she was in psychoanalysis in between. That sounds nice, right? Take a break from your career, get completely psychoanalyzed, and come back and do something else. But there's some lyrics from this song, Honey, that I think really speak to that kind of contemplative. I mean, these are some heavy lyrics for a pop song. So listen, this is the second verse. Can you open up to the pleasure, suck it up inside like a treasure, let the brightest place be your passion? Can you open up to the pleasure, suck it up inside like a treasure, let the brightest place be your passion? And she goes on to say, I got your honey, baby. Let go of your doubts. Say yes. Let it soak up into the flesh. Never had this kind of nutrition. Right? I mean, it really is about self-care, like explicitly
right, right.
So. This is not even about
it's
a
like
relationship,
a bomb,
even
yes.
a breakup. It really is about almost being able to feel joy again.
Yeah, I think, you know, the lover that she's addressing on that song really does seem to be herself, most of all. And the key line in that song is really fascinating, where she sings, you're not going to get what you want, but baby, I have what you need. It's kind of the opposite of the Rolling Stones line, right? You can't always get what you want, but you can get what you need. And it's, again, this kind of elusive thought of what would it mean not to get what you need? And is it possibly illusory to seek what you need? And is there something else that you can find? And that exploring that through this kind of anti-pop that Robin's always done feels like a really affecting and effective approach.
All right. Well, Carl, before we lose you, can you pick out maybe a pet favorite from the new record we should go out on?
Yeah. My favorite song on the new album is called Because It's in the Music, which is kind of a meta pop song. It's a song about songs. It's a song about sadness again, but it's about listening to a song that reminds you of a moment or a person and being driven to play it, even though it breaks your heart every time. And of course, like all such songs, it becomes one of those songs in the course of discussing that song. It's funny, it starts with a reference to Stardust. The first lines are, they wrote a song about us. It's called something like Stardust. And on the day they released it, same day you released me, even though it kills me, I still play it every night. And so it's this kind of flex at the beginning to say, Stardust was written about you, the 100-year-old American songbook standard. And then gradually to absorb the idea of songs like Stardust and songs about songs and bring it onto the into this kind of very Donna Summer-ish light strings and disco pulse music. And yeah, it's one of the ones that I come back to again and again.
They wrote a song about us. It's called something like Stardust. And on the day they released it, same day you released me, even though it kills me, I still play it anyway.
All right, well, Carl Wilson is Slate's music critic. Carl, as always, a total pleasure to have you on the show. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you guys so much.
Hello, listener. Dahlia Lithwick here, host of Amicus, that's Slate's podcast on the courts and the law and democracy and the rule of law. This May, our team will be publishing a special project that we are calling How Originalism Ate the Law. This neutral and academic-sounding methodology of looking at the law is, in fact, anything but neutral. Originalism is to the conservative legal movement what peanut butter is to jelly. As we're going to show you over the course of this project, originalism has been both cover and calling for conservative justices and judges to radically overhaul the lives of millions of Americans. And while they claim to be the apolitical interpreters of the Constitution and its authors' intents, they have overturned Roe, radically expanded gun rights, and eviscerated voting rights. Across Slate.com and the Amicus podcast, we're going to be tackling questions like, where did originalism come from? Why has it taken over? Are progressive originalists really a thing? And am I allowed to have an opinion on originalism? Spoiler, the answer to that last question, you are. To celebrate the launch of this big project, we are running a special 2-week-long free trial of Slate Plus on Apple Podcasts. As a member, you'll get exclusive episodes from How Originalism Ate the Law, plus ad-free listening to all of your favorite Slate podcasts. Join now by clicking Try Free at the top of the Amicus show page or visit slate.com/amicusplus to get access wherever you listen.
Blank Check is a very, very, very fun podcast on the pretty small chance, I think, that there are listeners of ours who don't know it and don't listen to it. You should absolutely check it out. It's hosted by David Sims. And I'm going to have David, who's your co-host? I'm sorry.
That's fine. Griffin Newman, actor and comedian Griffin Newman is my co-host.
And you're going to do it better than I can. So why don't you tell people what the premise of the show is?
Sure. So it's basically it's a film show about directors that looks at directors who got a blank check, quote unquote, from Hollywood that allowed them to make sort of a big crazy passion project or some weird expensive movie that defied the usual rules of blockbusters. And we sort of look at the arc of their career movie by movie and see like if the checks, if they cash or if they bounce. That is sort of the joke premise. And, you know, we're always in the middle of some director's filmography, but you can sort of go back and pick any director you like, really, that we've covered in the past.
But when you do a director, you do their entire filmography?
We do, because the arc of the career is part of the fun. Like, you know, the sort of the early things that maybe get them the Hollywood attention, and then the big splashy things that either get them more attention or put them in Hollywood jail or whatever.
Okay, so give me an example of a classic episode of your show. Director who, you know, sure, had the big hit, got the blank check, and what the arc was.
We just did Ang Lee, who is fun because he just absolutely cannot confine himself to a genre. Like, every new movie, he's doing something that he's never really worked in before. And even when you put him in, like, even when he makes a superhero movie, he made his Hulk. It's this bizarre Freudian, like, sort of experiment, like, rather
Killer
than
Killer Poodles. That's all I remember.
What a movie that is.
Hulk.
2003.
Hulk. We both think this is, like, a totally fascinating movie.
And such a
quintessential... And it's only gotten more fascinating as the, like, superhero genre emerged after it.
This is the kind of movie you get to make when you direct a foreign language film that makes $120 million.
For sure. Right. Exactly.
And that's like the blank check phenomenon that you and I talk about, which isn't just like, oh, I made a hit. It's like, how did that work?
Right. You did something that on paper would never go.
Right. So the studio just has to give you money because they can't rip you off. They're like, they've figured something out. We need to give them another at bat.
And beyond that, it's like they'll even give you a property like this one, a beloved comic book character.
Right.
And you're
Example, our first director that we did was M. Night Shyamalan, who after a couple false starts, he gets The Sixth Sense. He makes this big movie that is this unexpected hit and uses the capital for that on increasingly sort of like staggeringly strange projects like Lady in the Water and The Happening, these spectacular kind of failures that were entirely like from the mind of visionary M. Night Shyamalan, who had this sort of crash and then rebound now, making these little cheap horror movies in which he made this movie Split last year that he decided to make it a secret sequel to his old movie Unbreakable. Like, he's the classic sort of up, down, up again arc. But
he's gotten a whole book of blank checks, that guy.
Yeah, he really did. And but then one of my favorite miniseries that we did was on the Wachowski siblings, who again, you know, broke out of the gate with The Matrix and made these very expensive, very strange movies like Speed Racer and Cloud Atlas and Jupiter Ascending that
have a hardcore fandom.
That do
among a small niche of people.
I'm fond of them that are smuggling all kinds of strange ideas into very, very like summery blockbusters. And I hope they come back. They just shut down their production office in Chicago, but you know, they're a classic example.
So give us an example of someone who made the hit, got the blank check, and made a masterpiece.
The obvious boring candidates like Christopher Nolan or James Cameron, you know, who only sort of go up and up. Like they, you know, Christopher Nolan makes Memento, gets him on the map. He makes the Batman movies, that gets him more on the map. Then he starts making his movies, like his Inception or Interstellar, these movies that he obviously like has always wanted to make, and that only gets him more on the map.
Right, they're not weird, quirky.
Right, there are some that are
projects.
Just
they're giant things.
A straight up bar graph. I mean, I always one director we did this year, Paul Verhoeven, to me is a very fun example of a total weirdo who just sort of accidentally makes these huge hits, RoboCop and Basic Instinct. And uses that to make like absolute lunacy on a Hollywood scale. I mean, Starship Troopers being the sort of apex
so
of that.
Good,
right,
so good.
Right.
And what about directors you haven't done? There's some obvious candidates that you haven't talked about. Quentin Tarantino being one.
Sure. Yeah, there are a few sort of major American directors that we have avoided. Tarantino, the Coen brothers, David Fincher, who are obvious, you know, example. Like, they are exacting filmmakers who demand high budgets and work with big stars, and so they get to do what they want. But they're a little less fun, sort of career arc wise, than some of the people we've talked about.
So you want somebody
we
to
like
have
the boom
a patchy
and bust
career,
So you know, I mean, it's a way for us to just talk about movies and talk about directors and things like that, and be very silly. And my co-host is a comedian and an actor, and he's got his sort of side of the business that he's looking at things from. But you know, also it is funny how Hollywood to think about how Hollywood works and how it is always worked.
Do you talk about the business angle much? I mean, given that we just talked about Orson Welles and searching for studio funding and independent funding, do you look into sort of the production history of each movie you talk about?
Yeah, especially like a stranger movie like Ang Lee's like Billy Lynn's Long Halftime Walk, which was shot in this absolutely extraordinarily bizarre format.
What's the number of the frame rate?
120 frames per second.
So it's double the Hobbit movie, which already was utterly
bizarre. It's like triple the Hobbit movie. And did you see it? Did you see it in the
film? No, like, I've seen the Hobbit movie, and I never want to see anything in that format again.
It's like looking at when you're looking at the screen, it's like there's no screen. It's like you're looking through a giant window at people, like at giant people. It's very, very strange.
I don't need to get to know actors' pores that well.
You get to know them. You can see the veins in their face in that movie.
Well, one of the things that does, and I guess this is less of a problem in something like Billy Lynn because it's a realist movie, but in the Hobbit movie, it made all the props look really fake.
That was the issue
like
with
Gandalf's
the Hobbit movie.
So like Gandalf's staff or whatever, you can just tell that it's made of resin, you know?
And you can tell the
dwarves. It exposes the artifact.
Have fake noses.
Way.
Yeah, no, I think in Billy Lynn, the idea was that he's experiencing life in this sort of hyper real way. He is so traumatized by the war. There was artistic value to what he was doing. It just was a very strange viewing experience, but we like talking about stuff like that. And the box office, things like that. You know, the things that guarantee you the next check or not.
Right. It's a great idea for a podcast, but in part because it's not an obvious idea for one.
Sure.
What about that specifically coughs up to the surface, you know, unique insights into the way Hollywood works and what movies end up, you know, being?
Well, for one, there's the obvious insight as we keep going on and try to find new directors that most of the directors who get these blank checks are men, obviously, the way Hollywood works in that way, where one's crazy, tormented genius sort of persona often can be sort of bonded to one's male genius persona, and which Other Side of the Wind is another. There's another tie to that, but when we did a Catherine Bigelow miniseries because she was sort of one of the only women who's worked on the biggest scale that we like to sort of talk about, and it's amazing how much Hollywood will put certain directors, quote unquote, in Hollywood jail.
So what are you calling Catherine Bigelow's blank check movie or movies?
Well, she made K-19 The Widowmaker, which is the first $100 million movie made by a woman. So no one remembers that movie. It's absolutely so insanely boring. But her blank check to me is that now she, at least for a couple of movies, she made like a 3-hour epic about torture.
Right.
And it was a huge hit. Like things like that. Like that, yeah. Zero Dark 30. I'm talking, yeah. And then she makes Detroit, and that wasn't so much of a hit. But she, right now, she seems to command. It's the directors who can command a studio to just make whatever it is they want rather than like work within the more usual confines of how Hollywood works today.
And is there any kind of fruitful generalization to make about whether constraints, especially budgetary, or lack of constraints make for better popular art, or is it just so case by case?
It would sound very lame for me to say that I'm in favor of constraints, but constraints can be good, you know, and pushing against a studio or a producer or something like that. Or in the case of television, which we don't really cover TV much, but in case of television, I feel like sometimes I'll be watching a show and thinking, this could have done with some constraints. You know, this could have done with someone saying, like, this has to be 22 minutes long, or, you know, you got to get to the plot faster here.
Nodding vigorously over
here.
Sure.
And in movies, sometimes, I mean, think of Orson Welles, like almost any movie you watch of his, except for Citizen Kane, you're watching with the narrative in your head of like, oh, he was fighting against this studio, or he was trying to get this in there and he couldn't, or he had to cast Charlton Heston as a Mexican guy or whatever. And, those narratives are part of so many movies that we love. And it is interesting to consider them, like, you know, even Starship Troopers, like he's sneaking ideas past you. And it's fun to watch any director do that.
Right.
Past the censors or past the editors or past.
Have you done Soderbergh?
love to do Soderbergh. The only issue with Soderbergh, who I would love to do, is that he has made a gazillion movies. Like, there might have to be some editing with him. But every little weird project is more delightful than the last.
At this point, he has his own blank checkbook,
he really
right?
does.
I mean, he just does his own, he's off in his own world.
And he also right. is, he tries to do things that are not done. Like, he tries to market movies in weird ways. Like, the movie he made last year, the NASCAR...
Oh yeah, Lucky Larry. What the hell was it called?
Logan Lucky. Yeah. There we go. You know, he made that for pretty cheap after getting some stars together, and he tried to sort of like do this unusual marketing campaign where he focused the trailers in places that Hollywood usually ignores, and it didn't really work. But it's sort of fun to consider someone who's like, you know, is the formula a bad idea? Like, can we release movies in different ways? Like, things like that.
You've done Peter Jackson, of course.
No, he's on the list. I mean, we got to do him. The only problem with him is you got to do six Lords of Rings, you know, with increasing diminished returns. But yeah, we do like, I mean, the franchises can be fun to sort of.
Actually, Peter Jackson has a project that's supposed to come out this year that seems really interesting.
It's
some
War
sort
I
of
thing.
Colorized documentary of World War One footage. Yeah.
It seems pretty cool.
So I can't not ask you about this because for years I've been working on a project derived from the book Final Cut by Stephen Bach, which tells the story of the demise of United Artists because they wrote one single blank check to the director Michael Cimino as a consequence of him having won so many Academy Awards and universal accolades for The Deer Hunter. It's the kind of ultimate blank check story. Have you guys done it?
No, I mean, those... Heaven's Gate, as you say, is the ultimate blank check for sure, both in scale and in the disastrous aftermath, right? In sort of the impact it had. I'd love to do him. He's also got a fairly short and sort of arresting career. William Friedkin is another of those. Those, you know, the new
That's
Hollywood
one.
Guys.
Yeah.
Are the guys who sort of invented this concept where right. like the studio system was sort of breaking down and they would make their big movie, like Friedkin makes, you know, The Exorcist and French Connection, or Cimino makes Deer Hunter, and then they're like, great, I'm going to do what I want. And
like Coppola's Godfather was that
Coppola,
for him. He considered
absolutely.
It a pop player. Like, I got to make this damn mafia film
right.
so
one
I can
them,
make
one
the conversation.
Right, right. And, you know, and then sometimes, like, you'll get Cimino going off and blowing, you know, tens of million dollars in the West, and you'll get Friedkin making Sorcerer, and it's one of those things where, like, more and more money is being thrown at this project that absolutely will never be commercial. And, I love thinking about those, and I'm sure you do too, Stephen.
Oh, my gosh, endlessly. All right, well, the podcast is really cool. It's called Blank Check. Check it out. All right, moving on. All right, well, now is the moment in our podcast when we endorse Dana. What do you have?
Well, since I headed off our Orson Welles has a new movie segment by saying that I don't really regard The Other Side of the Wind as an Orson Welles movie, I feel like I should endorse Orson Welles' actual last movie as a director, which if you haven't seen it and you are fascinated with him as a figure, it's a far superior movie to The Other Side of the Wind qua movie, and it also is the thing that he wanted to make. It's called F for Fake. It was made in 1973, and it's his only real documentary. I mean, calling it a documentary is a little bit of a stretch because, like The Other Side of the Wind, it's this very nested, meta, yeah. crazy movie that's all about, you know, its own making, and it has these kind of tricky mirrors that it draws the viewer into. But it is about two real art forgers, and it's about art forgery in Europe. It's from a period when Welles was living in Europe and is largely shot there. And it's really hard to describe what F for Fake is, but it's just a movie that is really fun to be drawn into and fooled by. And also Oya Kodar, Welles' late life lover, has a big part in F for Fake as well. So if you want to kind of track what he was doing during those years, it was actually made right in the middle of the period, 1970 to 1976, that he was shooting The Other Side of the Wind. So when he wasn't running around cajoling the Shah of Iran to give him completion funds for one movie, he was churning out this other little 88-minute documentary that is just really a gem, F for Fake. And you can see it, sadly, on Filmstruck,
yeah.
soon not to exist. Ooh. You can also rent it on iTunes and find it out there in the world. F for Fake by Orson Welles.
I wasn't aware of how many movies he left incomplete at the time of his death. The documentary goes into it. I mean, there are a bunch. Merchant of Venice, the couple others that looked really intriguing. One that someone says is essentially done and it was just an act of perversity not to finish it.
I mean, if nothing else, I would love to see a documentary, a really well-made documentary that incorporated that footage without claiming, you know, that it was turning it into what it was meant to be.
Sometimes you just want a documentary to be a little more boring, like as much as like Morgan's Neville is doing all this, you know, energetic stuff. Like sometimes I'm just like, can you just tell me exactly what it is that we've got here? Yes. Because I actually am just fascinated for a factual kind of readout.
Exactly. Well, there's there's several talking head moments where they talk to Orson Welles' daughter and she's never identified as his daughter. You have to put it together from context and then look up what her name is. And I know he's trying to avoid being the boring documentarian who slaps the name up there, but come on, give us the name.
Right.
Be boring. Agreed. David, what do you got?
I guess I will, after slamming the Netflix movie, though, I will speak up for the Netflix movie this week, which no one seems to like except for me, which is Outlaw King, in which Chris Pine plays Robert the Bruce. Even though Chris Pine is not a Scottish man, and he might be an odd choice for the hero of Scottish independence from the 13th century, it is kind of an amazing movie by a Scottish filmmaker, David Mackenzie, sitting everyone down 20 plus years after Braveheart and saying, like, can we finally acknowledge that, you know, that movie was full of it, and like this whole process and the process of liberating our glorious country was muddy and nasty and horrible and brutish. And it's a bit of a grueling watch, I guess. I saw it at the Toronto Film Festival when it was 2 hours and 20 minutes long. It's now 2 hours. Apparently he watched the cut and was sort of like, okay, I can slim this down a little bit. But I think it is kind of a fascinating rebuttal to the sort of stirring Celtic heroism movies that were especially popular in the 90s. And I don't know, I'm a fan.
Oh my God, you had me at Chris Pine. One of our standing slogans here at the Slate Culture Gabfest is the Pine stands tall. We love Chris Pine
love
and all
too.
That he does.
He's very gruff and brooding. You know, he's brooding in this one. It's a lot of brooding. It's a brooding time.
Chris Pine brooding, I'm there.
The Pine stands tall. I don't think I ever signed off on that.
Julia and I think Julia and I coined it.
I love Chris Pine.
I think possibly you did. All right. I'm going to go low and then go high. I want to do something. When we first started doing the show and the concept of endorsements was suggested to us by Andy Bowers, I think it was really open-ended. I think the question was whether you might even thumbs down something or single something out for its, you know, corruption or vacuity or whatever. And very quickly, I don't think we ever did it. I think we just determined that a show built around three snobs sitting around chitting on popular culture was probably best to go out on a high note, you know, as a little bit of a sweetener at the end. But I now want to do it. It's the first time I've ever done this. I have to single out something for being just uniquely corrupt and inapt in our particular moment and just terrible, and it's also a sort of revocation of a previous endorsement. I once endorsed the introductions to Penguin Classics are typically beautifully written. The person writing them has been selected with enormous care, and they tend to be very intelligent essays that stand up on their own, and maybe they even deserve to be published separately in separate volumes. Some division of Penguin thought it was a good idea to bring out an anniversary edition of Solzhenitsyn's Gulag Archipelago, obviously a hugely historic work in the history of the moral imagination, and give the task of introducing it to, any guesses?
Snooki. I don't know. It just the buildup, I was like, better, who could this
better,
be?
Better Snooki than Jordan fucking Peterson.
Oh.
I mean, that is such a fuck up. That is such a fucking fuck up. You can't. And people have begun excerpting like some of his more outrageous, I mean, comments, you know, sweeping generalizations that literally an eighth grader with Google could tell you in under 10 seconds are untrue. I mean, they don't pass a laugh test to begin with, but if they got past the laugh test, you can just disprove instantly. And why mar a work like this with this lowbrow, manipulative, sub-fascist, you know, demagogue,
idiot. I don't even get the thinking there. Like, what's the connection? Maybe if it was something, some sort of work of like mythology or something, right? Isn't he really into like creating your own mythology or something? But a memoir from a gulag? Yeah. What does that have to do with
first? Him? First of all, they just want to move units, right? Sure. That is, they believe they can now sell, and they're probably right. Like multiples, a hundred times more copies, maybe 1,000 times more copy. And I'm sure I know what people like this say to themselves as they fall asleep, which is, you know, better that a million people read Solzhenitsyn than only 1,000, right? Like, if the price is that there are some whopping sub-fascist generalizations in the introduction, it was worth it. Well, fuck that. That's bullshit. But I think the thinking is that Peterson represents this kind of, you know, setting aside all of the, you know, pseudo-Darwinian idiocy of it and Jungian mythomania of it. You know, he's basically, at the end of the day, he's like very much a Steven Pinker style. You know, if you understand science, you understand that free markets are the height of, you know, human civilization, and that they think, or whoever the fucking idiot editor was who approved this, they think that that represents kind of the, you know, opposite of a Stalinist or Gulag-based, you know, socialist system or something. I have no idea, but it's a fucking horrible, outrageous decision. And it's the only time I've ever done this, but seriously, from the bottom of my heart, fuck you to the idiot who did this. but now let's go out on a slightly, slightly nicer note. There was a blackout in Ghent, New York over the weekend, pitch black. The whole world goes so dark in a place like Ghent, New York. And we lit a fire in the wood stove. We lit a ton of candles. And my daughter, my 12-year-old daughter, for whom this was complete agony, and therefore, of course, I loved it. It was like so great. No screens, no nothing. She had this little portable speaker that's battery powered, and I was able to Bluetooth up to it with my phone. And I put on a jazz album called Long Ago and Far Away. It's a Charlie Hayden, I think a posthumous Charlie Hayden record with the pianist Brad Meldau, M-E-H-L-D-A-U. And I'm endorsing both it because it is a sublime, it's such a deep mood, ethereal piano jazz record. It's great. I mean, I cannot tell you how it works on me like a fucking drug. But it was also shutting everything else down and out. It was such a zen. It was so amazing just to have. I mean, I know, Dana, you've said this over and over again, and I've ignored it every time, about the technology Sabbath every Saturday or whatever it is you do. But it was something about just no lights, candles, one piece of music that you're going to listen to from beginning to end, and you're not going to multitask, and you're not going to let screens invade this moment that you're having with one another. And then, of course, the lights pop back on, thankfully, after about a half an hour, but they pop back on, and like we all retreated to our fucking screens. But it was really amazing. So anyway, the album is called Long Ago and Far Away, Charlie Hayden and Brad Meldau. We'll post it on our site. You too. Two film critics. I got through, I got out of here alive. I talked about movies with two film critics.
And you didn't even give us a slap like Susan Strasberg gets as Pauline Kael in that movie.
David, thank you so much for coming on the show. And I'm very excited to have discovered I'm a huge fan of your criticism. And now I'm a fan of your podcast.
That's very nice of you to say. Thank you so much for having me on the show.
Yeah,
it's really
was awesome.
Exciting.
It was good. Come back, please. And of course, Dana Stevens. Thanks, Dana.
Happily come back.
Thanks, Steve.
You'll find links to some of the things we talked about today at our show page. That's slate.com/culturefest. And you can email us at culturefest@slate.com or drop us a note at our Facebook page. That's facebook.com/culturefest. We have a Twitter feed. It's @SlateCultFest. Our producer is Benjamin Frisch. Our production assistant is Alex Barish. For Dana Stevens and David Sims, thank you so much for joining us. We'll see you soon.